Okay, thanks, John. So I'm going to give a sort of a neural field theory talk. So if you haven't come across neural field theories before, hopefully you can use this as sort of an introductory seminar. And I'll, you know, hopefully throughout the talk you'll come to realize what I mean by bumps, breathers, and waves. So I've been asked to talk about coupled cells, and the cells that I'm going to talk about are neurons. So I want, you know, eventually I'll be talking about networks of neurons or tissue level descriptions, but the fundamental beast is the neural cell. So just got a little picture of a neuron up here, start us off. We don't need much neurobiology for this talk, so this is the only sort of biological slide here. So here's a cell that you might see in the cortex, a pyramidal cell. There's a cell body, there's a big branch structure, the dendritic tree, and this really captures inputs from other neurons in the network. And there's typically one output line, an axon, and I don't know which one it is, so I've drawn a little cartoon over here. So the cell body, this is, if you like, the information processing unit. This is the part of the cell that makes decisions. And cells typically either fire or don't fire. So the output of the cell, I'm going to regard as an electrical spike that propagates along this output line, the axon. And this tree is just there to grab information. So what happens is the cell somehow is given enough activity that it can fire an action potential. This propagates along this electrically active cable, where it arrives at the end of, when it gets to its terminus, I've blown up here, there's what's called a synaptic cleft. There's actually a physical gap between the end of an axon and the junction it's making with its partner neuron. So what happens is electrical activity knocks out chemicals, these drift across and bind to receptors in this postsynaptic membrane and induce some change in electrical potential here. So the synapse basically means this system in this net, when I'm thinking about networks, a synapse introduces a distributed delay of the signal. So the tree just grabs signals, the synapse filters signals, and the signals are the outputs of the cell body. And I'm going to take these to be spikes of electrical activity. And I've just got a little cartoon of an output of a neuron here. Now I want to connect these up into networks and tell you about what an unforced network can do, what sort of natural dynamics it can support. So I'm going to really be thinking about, if you like, traveling waves as a typical sort of dynamical phenomena. So here's a cartoon of my network. So I'm going to jump straight to a sort of continuum mechanics description and talk about densities of neurons. I'm going to arrange these neurons, or at least their cell bodies, on a line. So I'm talking about a one-dimensional brain, if you like. These neurons talk to each other through some anatomical connections with a strength that just depends upon the distance they're separated. So W tells you about the connectivity in the network, and the strength of connectivity is just a function of distance between cells in the network. The output at a point X is just going to be a spike train, and this is felt by a dendritic tree of a partner neuron. And all that neuron does, really, we can imagine to a first approximation, is filter that input. So it processes that spike train. And I'm going to represent all the biology of the synapse, and indeed all the biology of the dendritic tree, in some filtering. So the input to the tree is some spike train, and what the cell body feels is some filtered component of that. So this asterisk here represents some sort of temporal convolution, and all the biology for synapses is in this filter shape eta. Now it's quite hard to study these networks because they're spiking. It's very hard to deal with the questions about where are the spikes at any given moment of time, how are they impinging on the synapses. So what people typically do to get a simpler model is to say, well, it's not really maybe the spikes per unit, it's not really the spikes that are so important, it's the number of spikes per unit time that are important in generating interactions. So I'm going to go to a level of description where we imagine synaptic processing is slow, so that really I can throw away spike trains in favor of instantaneous firing rates. So I'm going to lose correlations in spike trains, if you like. And this gives rise to these so-called neural field models. So this is a neural field model, which we can trace back to the work of Wilson and Cowan in the 70s and indeed Amari. So the fundamental output at point X is some set of spike trains. I won't be able to deal with spike trains properly, so I'm going to deal with the number of spikes per unit time. I'm going to imagine if the activity at the cell body is high, then a neuron can generate quite a lot of spikes. It can generate a high firing rate. So the output of the neuron is a spike train, but I'm going to replace that by some firing rate. I'm going to call that F. and the fire rate is going to be some function of the activity at that point in the network. So U, this variable U, you can think of as synaptic activity or cell body activity. Now the outputs of the neurons are passed to other neurons in the network, so we can imagine some spatial convolution representing the anatomical connections, and some temporal filtering representing the dynamics of the synapse. So we've got this self-consistent nonlinear equation for U here. Now this firing rate function F, I've written it in terms of some parameter H. And we can think of this as a threshold in the sense that if you drive the neuron above some threshold, then it will fire a lot. And if you drive it below that threshold, it won't fire so much. So common choices for F are some sigmoidal function. And for a lot of this talk, I'll make the extreme simplification that the neuron is either firing as fast as it can or not firing at all. So this function here becomes a Heaviside function. But I will keep the notion of this threshold. Okay, so this is like, if you like, the standard neural firing rate model. But what I want to do is really talk about the dynamics, the interesting dynamics that you get when you consider the threshold itself to adapt in the presence of high activity states. So this is the non-trivial tweak of the standard neural field model. Now this is sort of nice because there's a statement by Hill going back to 1936, which is before the advent of detailed conductance-based neurons, such as Hodgkin-Huxley models, which recognize the existence of thresholds in neural tissue. And he said the following: the threshold rises when the local potential is maintained and reverts gradually to its original value when the nerve is allowed to rest, implying that nerve cells or nerve tissue can get knackered. It can't fire as fast as it can all the time. There's some metabolic process that likes to bring down activity in networks. And when he imagined that's the way to achieve that is to consider some threshold, which if the network is highly active, the threshold goes up, makes it harder for the neuron to fire. So here's a simple phenomenological threshold dynamics. The threshold H likes to go back to some natural value, H naught, but if activity is high, U is activity, and I'll represent this theta as a measure of highness, you know, there's another threshold in the system. If activity can outcompete this threshold theta, then instead of going to H naught, the threshold is driven to H naught plus kappa. So there are basically two thresholds in the system, your natural one and the one you might be pushed to in the presence of highly active states. Now I realize it's maybe a bit of a jump for me to talk about dynamics of this guy plus a tweak, so I thought I'd just take a step back and tell you about some solutions of this integral equation on the real line. Sort of a warm-up exercise, if you like. So to do that, I'm going to, you know, first of all, I have to complete my network description, so I have to make some choices. So how do I connect up the neurons? Well, sort of a part of the folklore of neural field theories is if you study systems with short-range excitation and long-range inhibition, then you can get interesting patterns to form. So I will take a network anatomy, which is precisely that. So you excite your neighbors, but you inhibit your cousins, your distal cousins. I might make a choice for that shape, but it doesn't really matter. But it'll be of a sort of a Mexican hat style. In terms of synaptic processing, what typically happens is at the synapse, a spike arrives at the synapse, and if you look at the signal on the postsynaptic side, then it takes some time for the signal to build up on the postsynaptic side, and it falls away. So I could take some difference of exponentials in time, or another common choice is a so-called alpha function, a function like t e to the minus t, with a rise time 1 upon alpha. So let me talk about the standard network with a constant threshold. There's no threshold accommodation. So first of all, let's look at some examples of time-independent solutions, spatially localized solutions in particular. So this is the equation describing time-independent solution. U is some convolution of the anatomy with f of u with relative to the threshold. This is quite hard to solve for a general f, although it does have a nice convolution structure, so you might apply some sort of integral transform theory. But as I said, I'm going to stick to this really simple notion of, you know, you're either firing or you're not firing, so this firing rate function is a Heaviside. which is nice because then, if you think about it, the right-hand side doesn't really see the shape of you. It just needs to know whether you is bigger than or less than some threshold. So if you imagine a solution of this form in the system, you know, a localized solution which is above threshold for some window in space of width delta, then you can write the solution down straight away. So all I'm saying is f is either 0 or 1 in some window, and I'll draw a solution like this to give you an idea. This window is just where this bump is. So my localized solution is the integral of w. I know w, I chose it, and all I've got to do is work out where you start to cross threshold and when you eventually come back down through threshold. So basically I've parameterized my solution in terms of the width here of the bump. So all you have to do is check that your solution crosses thresholds at the two points you've identified, x1 and x2. And if you do that, you get a self-consistent equation for the width of the bump delta as a function of the threshold. And I've plotted that over here. So here's the width of the bump. Here's the threshold. You see, if the threshold's too high, you can't support one of these localized states. But if the threshold is low enough, then you get a fat bump and a thin bump. There are two solutions. So it becomes interesting to ask about stability. Which of these two bumps might we see? So I'm going to examine the eigenspectrum of the linearized problem around my explicitly constructed one bump localized solution, and consider perturbations of this separable form, some function in space times e to the lambda t. And these perturbations satisfy this linearized system. So if I just tell you about the ingredients in this linearized problem, this eigen problem. So this L, so I'm solving the problem, this operator L on U equals U, and this operator L is really, you can see here I'm getting derivative information about my solution. Q is the solution, no surprises. W is fixed by us, and this e to twiddle is the Laplace transform of your synaptic response filter, which again I know I can work out. And for a Heaviside firing rate, this becomes a tractable problem, because when I chose Heaviside, I could construct solutions by hand. But moreover, for a Heaviside firing rate, if this f is Heaviside, then this derivative just picks up, it just becomes delta Dirac. Becomes a sequence of delta Dirac functions. So basically, you only get contributions to this integral here, this right-hand side, when your firing rate passes through threshold. And when you cross through threshold, you get a delta Dirac contribution to here. So what this means is you only pick out contributions to this integral where you cross threshold. And I've called those two points x1 and x2. So the derivative of my firing rate function is just given by the sum of these two delta Diracs. And if I plug that in on the right-hand side, I get something very simple, which says the perturbations everywhere depend upon what the perturbations are doing at these preferred points in the system, x1 and x2. And everything else is a known coefficient. W is my anatomy. E to twiddle is some transform of the synaptic filter that I chose. And again, W is my kernel. And I know the width of the solution because I've actually worked out what the solution is. So I really want non-trivial solutions to this. If I choose the perturbations at these preferred points to be zero, then the perturbations everywhere is zero. But if I choose on the left-hand side to evaluate my perturbations at x1 and x2, I can get a self-consistent system of equations for perturbations at those two preferred points. And that's what I've done here. I've just chosen x to be x1 and x to be x2 on the left, and seen what I've got on the right-hand side. So I've got a little two-by-two matrix system that tells me what the values x1 and x2 should be. And I want these to be non-trivial. So this coefficient here, A, is again built out of things I know. So non-trivial solutions really means I need the determinant of A minus the identity to vanish. And that equation there pins down the spectrum for this problem. So solutions are going to be stable if the eigenvalues found from the zero crossing of this function are all have real part negative. So here's, remind you of the solution structure, there's a fat bump and a thin bump. And if I plot this function, let's assume that it's real and lambda is real. If I pick a point up here and plot this E, this characteristic equation, then you can see and I need to find the zeros of this function. There's a zero when lambda is zero, and there's another negative eigenvalue. Now there's always a zero eigenvalue because I've got translation invariance. I'm on this infinite domain. I've got interactions that just depend upon distance. So this is calculated on this branch, implying this is stable. If I evaluate this E at the point here, I see a degeneracy, I get a double zero. And if I walk around the bend, come down here somewhere, and look at this function, I can see that there's a solution to the eigenvalue problem in the right-hand plane, suggesting that this, the fat bump, or the wide bump, to be more polite, is stable, and the thin bump is unstable. So I use this as an example, because later on I'm going to use these ideas to calculate the stability of more exotic objects, but that's the basic idea. I can make a lot of progress if I deal with fine rates, which are heavy side, they're either on or off. And if you want to learn more about this sort of thing, there are a couple of seminal papers in this area, one by Amari in Biological Cybernetics in 77, and another more recent one by Dave Pinto and Bardem and Trout in SIAM Journal of Applied Maths, 2001. So there may be some people in the audience that study stability of waves in more in sort of PDE settings. And in those settings, one often invokes the idea of an Evans function, something which pins down the discrete spectrum that tells you about stability of a localized traveling pulse. So that E that I put up on the last slide can be thought of as one of these Evans functions. So it doesn't matter if you've never heard of these things before, but basically my E has some properties that the spectrum is pinned down by getting this Evans function to vanish. So lambda, and in that case, lambda is an eigenvalue of my linearized problem. The order of the roots is equal to the multiplicity of the eigenvalues, and this function is analytic. And so you might use those to actually do some more proof-based work. But for me, I can, you know, you can give me any synaptic footprint. This is this anatomical structure. Any synaptic filter, and you can even put in more biological realism and account for the axonal delays in the system. At least for a heavy side, you can write these functions down in closed form, which typically you can't do for traveling wave solutions of PDEs. But we have got this special restriction that, you know, you're either firing or you're not firing. And there's a nice general paper about Evans functions for non-local equations by Todd Capitula, Nick Kurtz, and Bjorn Sandstedter, and myself and Marcus Owen have written one in the context of neural field theories. And this more general one has been shown by Bjorn to sort of subsume all the relationships we've derived for our particular model. So one can ask, well, I've got this machinery for talking about stability of localized solutions. Can I apply it in other contexts? Well, yes. And before I get to adaptive thresholds or dynamic thresholds, let's just look at some results in 2D. So in 2D, one can imagine that I use a really a two-dimensional wizard hat structure. I just have a proper sombrero-style interaction in my two-dimensional space. And I consider the two-dimensional generalization by one-dimensional bump, which is a rotated one bump, so a radially symmetric one bump. And you can ask, what is the width of that bump in two dimensions as a function of the threshold? And you get exactly the same trend as you see in the 1D case. There's a wide bump and a thinner bump. And I plotted on here this little dot just to show that below this dot, on this branch here, the solutions, they have this one bump structure with a peak here. But above this dot, they have a sort of a dimple at the origin. And that would be true in the one-dimensional case as well. But the question I want to get at is, do you see any new instabilities in 2D that weren't there in 1D? So I'm going to consider perturbations in this separable form, some function of space, some function of time, e to lambda t. But now I'm going to worry about perturbations in the angular direction. So I'm going to consider perturbations for e to the I m theta, where m is some integer. So if you put m equals naught in here, you're really doing, the same sort of stability analysis I did in 1D. I'm not worrying about angular perturbations. And if you look at the eigenvalues along this branch, yeah, there's a change of sign at the origin, but the eigenvalue on the lower branch is positive, and the eigenvalue on the upper branch is positive. So again, wide bump is stable, thin bump is unstable. Lambda 1 is identically 0 because we have some rotational symmetry. But if we look at lambda 2, there's a change of stability at this dot here, suggesting that these dimple bumps, although they're stable in 1D, they're not stable in 2D. And they would go unstable to perturbations, to eigenfunctions which have two dimples in them. So if we did a simulation, and that's what I'm showing here, and we simulate at that point where I predict the transition, and this is sort of a looking down on the activity variable, color-coded, so red is high activity, and I perturb with a mixture of two-mode and three-mode contributions. You'll see it start to split into two. On the right-hand side, all I'm showing is the difference between this new state and the original one bump. Again, you can see, so the two lobes emerge. So there are some differences in stability in 1 and 2D for these models. You can also study rings. It's easy to write down ring-type solutions, look at their instabilities, and Bill Troy and Carlo Lang have studied the stability of rings and show that they can break up into spots organized on a ring. And if you go to Bill Troy's website, he has lots of images, movies, of these 2D neural fields of ring structures breaking up into spots and multiple spots and so on. But there's also a movie on his website which shows localized bump solutions. Here's a three spot that start to undergo rotation. So I was always curious about this because I wasn't quite sure how they emerged in these neural field theories. So let me just describe the neural field theory that supports these rotating structures and again show how they can be understood in terms of instabilities. So the neural field that Bill Troy and Carlo Lang look at is something like this. So it looks a little bit different to my original purely integral equation, but it's very similar. So activity here, U, decays away and is being driven by input from other neurons in the network. Now the caveat in this model is that you've got some recovery variable. You couple your synaptic activity to some other field A, and A obeys this linear equation. So A likes to decay back to rest unless it's being driven by U, in which case it gets pushed up to U. So this doesn't look like an integral equation, but you can imagine my integral equation, I have these functions eta, and they can be imagined as the integrated form of equations of this style. So what I want to do is just quickly show you how you would expect rotational instabilities in neural field theories with this sort of linear adaptation. So what we do, we know we've got a hope of constructing these time-independent solutions. I would just call them Q of R, but you can imagine they can be bumps or multi-bumps, whatever you want, sitting in the plane. And then we can study the linearized problem. So I'm going to linearize around my known solution. I'll call it psi bar. It's my known solution. And I'll write everything in terms of these two component objects. One is U, the synaptic activity, and the other is A, this extra linear adaptive term. Because we've got these symmetries in the system, we know that there are just a Goldstone mode, the eigenfunction associated with the zero eigenvalue, which can be written in terms of the derivative of the known solution. So I already get an eigenfunction for free because of symmetries, called the Goldstone mode. And here's the defining equation for one of the Goldstone modes. Now, you can imagine destabilization occurs under parameter variation, where you get another eigenvalue running up to the origin and also crossing through the origin, so you get a degeneracy. So in which case, we'd imagine to give a complete description of the system, we need to worry about generalized eigenfunctions. So at the bifurcation point, we would expect a generalized eigenfunction to appear, which I'll call psi 1, which satisfies this equation here. So this Goldstone mode I've written as the angular derivative of my solution, and there are other Goldstone modes to do with translations, but I'm just going to worry about the rotations. Now I've got to worry that there's a sensible solution to this guy. So what I'll do, I'll consider the adjoint problem, first of all, and introduce a set of associated modes which solve this particular adjoint problem. I'll call them associated Goldstone modes. And if I project my Goldstone modes onto these other guys, the solvability condition for that last equation means this has got to vanish. And that's really my bifurcation condition. So you might think, well, that's not very helpful because, I know psi naught, these are these Goldstone modes, just derivatives of things I know about. Well, I've got to compute these other guys. I've got to solve this problem. But for these neural models, or this one in particular, these new associate modes can be expressed completely in terms of the things you already know. So it's easy to write down this bifurcation condition. And I've written it here. But the important thing is that this thing on the right-hand side has got to be set equal to zero. All the thing in this inner product is positive. So I get a condition that if the strength that you couple to this extra adaptive field increases beyond 1 over alpha is the rise time of the synapse, then you'll see a rotational instability. And that's what you can show with some neural. So here's the strength along here, and here's the frequency of rotation for some numerics of a three spot with various different values of alpha, and it undergoes transitions at precisely this value. Okay, so this is a historical perspective on neural fields, and now I want to get to the more funky stuff you see when you have adaptive thresholds. So this is the model. U is some spatial temporal convolution of f of u. There is a threshold in the system. This threshold is itself dynamic, motivated by statements that go back to the 30s. It's low if activity in the network is low, but it has the potential to become much higher if activity in the network itself gets higher. So I'm going to have two thresholds now, because there's this one which evolves in time, and there's this one here, theta, which is the switch for getting this stuff to do something interesting. So again, we could start again and look for these spatially localized solutions, these one bumps, and see if they have similar instabilities. But now I haven't just got to worry about what U is doing, I've got to worry about what this dynamic H is doing as well. So if I look for time-independent solutions, I'll call the one that goes with U, I'll call that Q, and the one that goes with H, I'll call that P. So a bit of notation, I've got spatial convolutions really defining my time-independent problem, so I'll introduce this cross to mean a spatial convolution. So again, you can write down solutions in closed form as long as this F is this on-off heavy side. You have a firing or you're not firing with respect to threshold, but now remember threshold can itself evolve. So let me just sketch a sort of a localized one bump that this system might support. So here's a one bump. This black line is the theta. So if the blue line gets above theta, you're really getting this threshold dynamics to start. And so if you're below theta, this dark line, the threshold is just at its lowest value, which is H naught. But if you get above the black line, the threshold is H naught plus kappa. You know, it's got two values it can potentially take on at this steady state. And so last time I parameterized my solution in terms of where the solution crossed thresholds, and I can do that again, but just the threshold itself is not constant everywhere. So here's a blow up of this region. So I'm going to introduce these three points, x1 here, x2 and x3. So x1 is where you cross H naught plus kappa, x2 is where you cross theta, and x3 is where you cross H naught. So I can write my solution in closed form, parameterized by those unknowns, x1, x2, and x3, and it's symmetric, so I can use minus x1, minus x2, and minus x3 as well. So this is I've got the shape of the solution, but it's parameterized by things I haven't fixed yet, so all you do is fix those by demanding your solution cross the thresholds where you thought it would do in the first place. So if I solve these three simultaneous equations, I pin down this solution. And it appears that if kappa is too big, then there aren't any solutions to these three equations. So I just look at stability, and I can whiz through this because it's the same ideas for the standard model. Consider perturbations of this separable form, some function in space times e to lambda t. This guy, the Laplace transform of my synaptic filter, will pop up again. But I'm going to write those linearized equations of motion out, and I'm linearizing around that bump I just showed you, which I called Q, but remember the threshold itself has a shape as a function of X, which I call P. So this is the linearized evolution of U, and it couples to the perturbations in the synaptic variable and the threshold variable, and the perturbations for the threshold variable evolve according to this. So I can eliminate H between these two to get this equation for my perturbations. But the idea is perturbations everywhere depend upon some spatial convolution of your firing rate function linearized around your solution with the perturbations. So that's a sort of nasty thing to study, but again, life becomes simple when you remember, well, if I take this heavy side, then these guys here, these derivatives just turn into delta Dirac's, and these convolutions just pick out information where you cross threshold. And I've got these six really threshold crossing points. So, where does Q cross P? Well, at the point x1 and x3. Where does Q cross theta? Well, at the other point, x2. So I can just plow on, and what I get, something like we had before, perturbations everywhere depend upon what the perturbations are doing at these preferred points where you cross threshold. And there are some known coefficients which just depend upon the anatomy the derivative of the solution, which we've already got, and the points of crossing, which I've already calculated. So again, I want non-trivial solutions to this. So I just plug in on the left the values x1 to x6, and I get six equations that I need to find a non-trivial solution of. And I can write down this Evans function again. So A of lambda is just something I know in terms of system architecture. And now I've got to study this guy, basically, and that'll tell me about stability. So one way to do this, really, and I'm going to be worried about, if you like, complex eigenvalues now. One way to do this, to unravel it, is to consider lambda to be written in this form, a real part plus I times omega, and then go to the complex plane and plot the function, the real part of this, and another function, the imaginary part of that, and where they're both zero, i.e. where these two functions have intersecting contours, are the zeros of this complex analytic function. So let me just plot up a picture to give you an idea of what I'm doing. So here's the complex plane. This nu represents the real part of the eigenvalue I'm trying to find, and this is the imaginary part. Where a blue line is where the real part of the Evans function vanishes, and the red is where the imaginary part vanishes. But where a blue and a red cross, that's an eigenvalue. That's picking out the discrete spectrum for this problem. So you can see here, there's some eigenvalues here, 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 etc. But I've adjusted parameters, so there's in fact a double zero eigenvalue on the real axis. So if I take a filter like this, a simple exponential, simpler than the difference of exponentials of alpha functions I put up early on, and pick a low kappa, so the threshold is either H0 or it's H0 plus kappa, I'm making kappa quite small, and as you increase this parameter alpha, which parameterizes the inverse rise time of the synapse, you can get an instability. You can get eigenvalues that are over here to move up to the origin and pass through the origin. And what that means for the bump is the following, that the bump can't sit still anymore, it's gone unstable, and it starts to drift. So there's the bump, and I've increased this parameter according to that diagram, which tells me how big to make it, and the bump doesn't sit still, it just starts to move. And you get a drifting bump, so I call this a drift bifurcation. And that's a wave in its own right. But the eigenvalue's crossed through zero on the real axis. Now, if we pick a higher value of kappa, that's no longer true. We can get eigenvalues to cross through with a non-zero imaginary component, indicative of a more dynamic instability. So last time it drifted, but if I can arrange parameters such that this happens, and the way to do it, pick a higher kappa, increase your parameter alpha in the synapse. Now what you see is the bump can't remain stable, but it will start to oscillate. So blue is the synaptic activity, red is the threshold, and you see that the solution starts to go up and down. So this is why I call, hence the word breather in my title. This is what I'm going to call a breather. So just a little summary. This is kappa. Threshold is over H0 or H0 plus kappa. If kappa is too big, you don't get these one bump localized solutions. If kappa is low enough, you can get instabilities by varying the time scale associated with the synaptic processing. Kappa's low, bumps drift. Kappa's high, they wobble up and down. You can keep going now. Hopefully you've got the idea. There is this machinery to study these systems. We've just seen a simulation that showed a bump drift off into a wave, so you can ask the same questions. Well, can I construct that wave? Can I look at its stability? And of course you can do all those things. But it would put you to sleep. So I'll just show you the profile. So this is the sort of solution I can imagine looking for in a traveling wave frame. So I go to a traveling wave frame. I introduce an unknown speed now. So not only have I parameterized my solution by where it crosses various, where thresholds are crossed, but I've got to work out how fast it's traveling as well. So it'll be a little bit more self-consistent. So this is the shape of the wave. It's parameterized by four unknown crossing points. So I've got to sort. So I can write down the solution in closed form, parameterized by those four points, and I just check at the end that I've done everything in a self-consistent fashion, work out what those points are, and hope that I've got enough equations to also pin down the wave speed C. And you can do that. And I plotted the results of doing that. So X3, you can regard as the width of this traveling pulse. There's a bump that's started to drift. It's basically, there's still a width there, and it's moving. And I parameterized my solution in terms of its width. And I want to know how the width varies as a function of one of the parameters, say alpha, something to do with the synaptic processing. And you see there's this line here. So these traveling waves tend to, they seem to exist over huge ranges of alpha. But if you then construct the associated Evans function and look at the spectrum, you see that there's two instabilities at these points here where these asterisks are. And they're both dynamic instabilities in the sense the eigenvalues sort of cross through on the imaginary axis, implying that this bump is going to do something interesting in time. And what I've done is show, we've just picked a point here in parameter space and done a simulation of the full integral equations of motion and plotted what you get. So if there was a pulse, traveling pulse, and you looked in the space-time diagram, you just expect to see a band, you know, a nice diagonal band with a diagonal picking out the wave speed. But what you see is that band, but it's modulated by something. Activity sort of changes as a function of time. These circles here are, again, the amplitudes of solutions taken from the direct numerics. So here's, it went very quickly, but I put one of my explicit traveling waves into an integral solver and started to evolve it in time, and you can see that the wave can't have a constant profile, but can have one that sort of wobbles up and down. Sort of but it looks a bit like some sort of shark's fin. But this model also has more interesting dynamics than just sort of bumps and breathers and wobbly waves. If you work in the regime where you know that one bump doesn't exist, you know, if I make this kappa too big, I know that one bumps can't persist. So you ask, well, if I load, a bump solution into my integral solver, how does it evolve in time? So this is what we've done. We put a bump solution in where we know one doesn't exist. And what happens is the bump can't exist, but it can split into two, and there can be further splitting. So you get a cascade of bumps emerging in the system. And again, here's a little movie. You put a bump on, you know it doesn't exist from the analysis, and it splits again, 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 again. And it will pattern the whole domain. So it would be nice to understand this, or nice to organize the, work out at least when the bumps start to split and when they start to split again.
What is the rule for adaptation?
The adaptive variable is the threshold. So the firing is a function of the threshold. The threshold is either decaying back to some uniform, steady, natural value, or it's being driven up to that value plus a constant. So it's a piecewise linear dynamics for the threshold. Again, that's why I can solve everything. Both U and H are, in some sense, piecewise linear systems. I can bolt everything together.
One related question to that. I've seen several papers where they say that the threshold adaptation goes both ways, not only up.
Up and down.
Yeah. Okay. Did you see that?
We didn't choose to study it.
Yeah, right. What do you expect?
Okay, so I don't know what the system would do in that context. Okay. Then imagine, I've got all these traveling waves and bumps. What happens if I start to throw them at each other? And it seems to be quite interesting. This is it's a model of a biological system. It's a dissipative system. No conserved quantities were built in. So you perhaps wouldn't expect too much to happen if you start bouncing waves at each other. But if you fire two of these waves, traveling waves at each other, what they can do is the following. They just seem to bounce off each other, implying that there's a neural field that you can write down, which has some relation to biology, we would hope, but it has entities in it that like to persist. And so if you're thinking about coding or memory states, this might be a useful way to, you might want objects like this, you might want persistent bumps in activity. What happens in 2D? Well, it's just all the same. So if you had a bump in 1D, you can get a bump in 2D. This is all the adaptive threshold. We had breathers in 1D, so we can have breathing localized states in 2D. So on the left is the synaptic variable, and on the right is the threshold variable. And you can get these localized states to travel. So we would call them maybe traveling spots or something. And again, these guys can bounce off each other. and there's the 2D breathing pulse. So everything that you saw in 1D seems to carry over to 2D. And of course, this is the breathing pulse, the guy that moves. You can't read, maybe at the back you can't see, but there are some oscillations around here. Well, what's also nice is these systems can have nice patternings. So we got earlier on, I knew how to get a one bump to split into two, because all I had to do is be in the plane and change my threshold to be at the point where a one bump solution developed a dimple at the top. If I put myself in that scenario again here, but I've got adaptive threshold now, you see the splitting initially, but then the adaptive threshold kicks in and creates some more interesting patterns with a well-defined wavelength. If you want to study collisions in the plane, you can also fire two objects together and see what they do. So here what we've got is a traveling breather being shot at another traveling breather, and they obviously interact and bounce, but they can also not interact not only by their shapes, but they've got a phase because they're oscillating. It becomes interesting to ask, what does the phase contribute to the scattering here? So that's it, really. I really didn't want to run up to the wine because you've become very unpopular, so I wanted to finish a little bit early. So let me just summarize what I've done. I've talked about neural field theories, and I've introduced the notion of an Evans function, which allows you to talk about stabilities of localized states and traveling pulses. I've also shown some examples of what I've called in the literature dispersive solitons, or auto-solitons, so it's dissipative systems that have solutions that scatter like solitons. And there may be ideas from work by Nishiura to tell you how these things might scatter, and also to organize how bumps might split into double bumps and cascade and so forth, organized around knowing where saddle node bifurcations are for the one bump solution. Also, because we see the emergence of objects that persist, they can bounce and scatter, you might think about going to a kinematic framework and just trying to track around the centers of masses of these guys in some sort of effective potential. And that work in those areas has been begun by Paul Breslov. And a lot of the solutions I've showed, you might have seen in other contexts. So there are several three-component reaction diffusion systems that have the sorts of exotic dynamics I've talked about at the end, as well as coupled cubic complex Ginzburg-Landau systems. So these integral equations don't look like those systems. So it'd be nice to work out what is similar between these integral neural field models and these more well-studied local dynamical systems. So let me just finish by recognizing all my collaborators on this project. So Marcus Owen from Nottingham, he's here in the audience somewhere. There he is, in the middle. Gabriel Lord from Heriot-Watt, who's also in the audience in the orange t-shirt just in front of him. And Carlo Lang from Massey in New Zealand. All this work is supported by EPSERC funding. Thank you.
Probably the wine
is yeah. It's very interesting. What's the role of the time scale or the threshold adaptation?
Well, I set that to one, and I measure everything relative to the time scale of the synapse. Mm-hmm. So everything is measured. So I speed up the synapse to get interesting things to happen relative to the time scale of adaptation in the threshold.
Yeah. So adaptation equal to synapse time scale. Because
when they're equal.
Or similar.
Well, the bifurcations tend to occur, like the ones that are oscillating wiggly traveling wave occurred about the time, it was about 1 point something. So it's very similar to the time scale for adaptation.
Because my understanding is that the adaptation is much slower.
Right. Well, you know, this is okay. I could just pick a I'm already working with a neural field theory, which is only valid, really, in its strictest interpretation for slow synapses. So, you know, I typically think of hundreds of milliseconds, really, to get these neural fields that agree with more spiking-based models.
You remind bump scattering, right? Is it always regular scattering, or it can be chaotic scattering? For example, bumps rotate a few numbers around, and after that go out, the number can be random?
So the answer is, we haven't done enough numerical studies to make an opinion, but if you look at, I would expect the sorts of effective kinematic descriptions to be thrown up to support chaotic scattering. There's no reason why not. So I would expect it in a full model as well.
You suggested the collisions because the waves, the shapes retain after a collision, that they might be good for encoding states because they're persistent.
Yeah.
What happens if they're slightly out of phase? What happens with the
Yeah, you're right. If they're out of phase, so if those just drifting bumps come to each other, and they're not the one we set them up with, you know, the one on the right is a mirror image of the one on the left, and they bounce. Yes. If they're not mirror images, then they can entrain and drift off together. But they don't have to destroy each other.
You get passing through each other like solar tons. No,
well, we haven't really seen that, no. Right. They tend to have identities.
You describe perturbations of your system with, say, two eigenvalues or maybe with six. But in fact, it is infinite dimensional system. So does it mean that other eigenvalues are minus infinity? Or what?
We're working with this special firing rate function, this Heaviside, which collapses the dimensionality of the problem down for us. So I'm not saying there are six eigenvalues in those examples, I'm just saying the system that which defines the Evans function could come from a six-dimensional system. So there still could be, I don't know how many eigenvalues there are.
I mean, if you, for example, smooth your functions from Heaviside to some smooth function,
yeah, so the big
other eigenvalues come from minus infinity.
Yeah, so it becomes straight away a much, much harder problem because, you know, perturbations everywhere are then determined in a self-consistent way. And I just can't say anything about that problem. Of course, when you take when you do numerical simulations with a smooth sigmoid that's quite steep, all these ideas, you know, they are predictive. But the mathematical problem of solving the full integral equation describing the perturbations is just beyond me.
Yeah, but that means that if you compare it to, let's say, biology, neurons here are firing at the saturation level.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question is whether you find all this diversity, I mean, the sequence of bifurcation, also if you assume a more realistic transfer function of the neuron and also more realistic dynamics of adaptation.
That's a good point. So we found that we can numerically solve these problems and do bifurcation studies where we track the steepness of a sigmoid. We can assume a sigmoid parameterized by its steepness and track the solutions out as a function of the steepness. Well, what I would say is even if you go back to Amari-style models and put a smooth sigmoid in, that sigmoid has to be really steep to see the bumps. So if we choose something.
But you can still get bumps without the saturation.
Yeah, yeah. So we have begun to look at other firing rates. And Carson Chow has done stuff with Heaviside plus linear beyond threshold and constructed a lot of solutions in the absence of adaptive thresholds. So I think the problem is, I can see flaws in these models and I'm fine, but what bothers me is that it's a firing rate model and it's probably more interesting to look at do these things survive in the spiking networks?
I'm asking the question because as far as my experience with threshold linear.
Yeah, threshold linear is what I meant,
with
yeah.
With linear adaptation, you find, of course.
Yes, so of course in your work, David's done some work on linear adaptation effectively, and you see the drifting bifurcations, yes. For example, but I guess that was linear adaptation. We've got non-linear adaptation that's solvable because it's piecewise linear, but we also see more dynamic instabilities, these breathing states emerge, as well as the splitting. I don't know if you saw the splitting with just linear adaptation and the scattering. I don't know if any of those effects go over if you just change the dynamics from a non-linear adaptation back to a linear one. The linear one's nice, of course, because you can use all this machinery even more succinctly to make statements about instabilities.
Paul, not an expert in this area, so I'm a bit confused about whether I'm going to say the same thing. But when you talk about linear, do you mean just something like that or something like this?
Something, okay, for everybody else, something like that.
Right. Like that, but with flat bits.
So you can essentially work in the linear regime.
Yeah, right. It's sensible to have a flat bit for high activity because neurons saturate, they can't fire arbitrarily fast.
Are you saying that some things disappear as soon as you have a finite slope?
I think that there is something here which has to do with this, yeah, the fact that you have...
Okay, so we can take what we've done and have sigmoidal functions which are quite steep and these things persist, but if the steepness of the sigmoid is too shallow, then you don't get maybe even the localized one bump solution.
Yeah. So I have to just show my shortcomings now. Somebody asked earlier, maybe the first question about what happened to all the other eigenvalues, as it were. But if I understood, but perhaps I didn't, the functions are only determined at these points in your discontinuous case. So if you perturbed elsewhere, then the perturbation...
Well, no, yeah, no, I perturb everywhere. I do consider perturbations everywhere.
But you only determine it in...
But then you get a self-consistent formulation that says perturbations everywhere.
Yeah.
Depend upon what's going on at special preferred points. So it's not like I'm perturbing only at special preferred points. It's just that the eigenvalue problem turns out that way.
So I still don't know the answer to the question then. What is it, an infinite co-dimension problem? I mean, when you allow a finite steepness rather than a discontinuity, just do lots of things come in that could...
Yes, it could be. But I just don't know enough to say anything about that problem, apart from the fact that I can't say anything about that problem.
You probably know a lot more than I do,
yes. Good topic for future investigation.
Yeah, I think there's lots of mathematical fun when you move away from the sort of cartoon ideas I presented, you know, firing rate is on or off. You know, how do you cope? You know, this analysis, you can't perturb this analysis, you know. You can't perturb away from the heavy side. You've got to start again, in some sense. We need some new techniques.
I was just wondering, you know, you said if you have a sigmoidal with steep enough gradient, then these things persist. I was just wondering, has anyone looked at how they persist, if you see what I mean? So as you sort of go from infinite to...
Yeah, so we've done some small studies. Gabriel in particular has studied some of these systems without adaptation and just asked, well, if you've got a one bump and you control the steepness of the sigmoid, you know, when does it vanish? And it vanishes in a saddle node bifurcation, but for quite high values of the steepness. So we have quantified it numerically. Like